Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Woohoo! Happy New Year, and welcome back to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, along with my 1 year older now co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Well, good afternoon. Definitely glad to be back. Welcome, everybody. Wow, conservative prime time for January 4th, 2013.
What show are you talking about? You said conservative primetime?
Oh, I'm sorry. Southern Sense.
You're out of practice.
I certainly am. But great to have you here for the Southern Sense 2013 edition. And everybody, we are glad that you are back. We all have our links, our Facebooks, our Twitters. I'll post all those links, including Stitcher and Spreaker. We're available on iTunes. We'll post all that info in the chat room as we always do. And at the end of the show, something special. Annie is going to draw a name. Which BTR hot female gets to go on a date with me tonight?
Is that what it is, Annie? No.
Then what do we do? What are we drawing for?
As I announced before the holidays, we are giving away one of our specially designed tote bags from our website, southernsense.webs.com. So out of 140 names, we are going to be drawing the lucky winner. I would have done it from the Facebook page, but that's about close to 2,000 names on there. I'm going to have to figure out how to include them for another drawing. Probably might be next drawing, might be like one of our coffee cups or cool hats or something. But today we're going to draw for the tote bag.
That's still pretty awesome. You know, TJ Thompson, for his show, had a $50 gift card for the first caller who could answer a question. He didn't get any callers. So for us to be drawing 140 names or so, that's great. And, of course, this is designed, everybody, by Annie herself, who is not only a perfectionist, but Annie is the type who, when I think of Annie, I think of somebody who says something like, they like the finer things in life.
Why, thank you.
You're welcome.
We have a fantastic guest that will be calling in at a quarter after the hour. So let's go ahead, and as everyone who listens to the show knows, that we dedicate each and every show to a fallen hero. And this fallen hero was killed on Christmas Eve, and that is why I chose him to be dedicated to today. So, Mike, if you would, pull up the Army music. And we will make this dedication to Army Sergeant Enrique Mondragon. A soldier from the colony in Texas has died while serving in Afghanistan as part of Operation Enduring Freedom. Sergeant Enrique Mondragon, 23, died Christmas Eve in Baraki Barak due to injuries sustained when his unit was attacked by small arms fire while on patrol. According to his memorial page on sanctuaryofmaryblogspot.com, he leaves behind a wife and two-year-old daughter. According to the press release issued by the military, Mondragon signed to the headquarters and headquarters detachment of the 173rd Special Troops Battalion based out of Bamberg, Germany. Specialist Ashley McCormick was stationed in Mondragon for 3 years. She met him on deployment in Bamberg, Germany in 2008, shortly before he learned he was going to be a father. He got married to Katie, and it took a little bit to get the paperwork done to get her over here, but he was able to be home for the birth, and shortly after, Katie and their daughter Beverly moved to Germany, McCormick said. The platoon, which McCormick said was the only airborne military police platoon in Europe, was deployed to southeast Afghanistan. The group was split, with half deployed to Kop Chark and the other half deployed to Baraki Barak, something McCormick called difficult. I can't begin to explain how close our platoon is, she said. Not only are you in the foreign country, but all you have is each other. And when you are training with every day, you see people you work with more than you see your actual family. We love each other. We are with each other every day. And as soon as we got off of work, we'd be hanging out. We couldn't get enough of each other. We are a huge family. After accomplishing its mission, Batoon was reunited in Baraki Barak. Some troops were ordered back to the States, but Mondragon extended his stay for a second deployment in the area of operation in Baraki Barak. Sometimes we have to convoy out to a certain area and conduct a mission. Their mission was to set up a traffic control point and talk to locals in the area using a hide machine. You can get their fingerprints, and you can take a picture of their eye. If anything did happen, enemy fire or casualty, then we would have that on record. That was what he was doing that day. As part of the convoy, the truck's gunners and drivers stayed behind while other personnel dismounted the vehicle. Mondragon was one of the dismounts in the mission, McCormick said. He was actually in the middle of getting information from a local, and a three-round burst went off, and one round of the three hit him, she said. That was it. We are like a family out here. We have gone through deployments before, but we have never lost anyone in our company. McCormick said the platoon is still trying to cope with the news, and with heavy sorrow, their thoughts and prayers go out to Mondragon's wife, Katie, and their daughter, Beverly. The whole platoon is heartbroken, she said. He was a small guy that made a huge impact in the platoon. I think what hurts us most is the concern for his wife and daughter. Katie is such an amazing person, an amazing mom, the perfect wife, and their daughter is such a beautiful girl. He was with them as often as he could be. It's heartbreaking to imagine what she is going through right now. For us in the military, we go through this every day, and we know what to expect. But for her, I wish there was more we could do for her. The colony mayor, Joe McCory, who has two children serving in the military and is a veteran himself, said Mondragon's death is a tragedy. I've been talking with the American Legion, and they're trying to get together with his family and help in any way possible. I understand he has been flown back to the States and will be properly taken care of. We want to be there both as a city and as a veteran in support of this family during these hard times. obituary said the timing of Von Dragon's death was unthinkable. "It's just something that no parent ever wants to face," McCrory said. "On one hand, you are proud of their service to the country. But on the other hand, it would be terrifying and devastating." Written on the sanctuary of Mary Page, "A person left behind. He was my neighbor's boyfriend, then husband. He was very enthusiastic first, and he always had a smile on his face. May the Lord Jesus Christ keep him in arms and look upon his family and give his family strength to accept God's will. Mary Quill's great. Take him by the hand to your son, Jesus Christ. Sergeant Enrique Mondragon, we dedicate this. And we also dedicate the song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon. We dedicate this to all the men and women out there who have served and are serving. God bless."
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger. And I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. My strength was not taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames. I'll always
not Alan Herndon. My name is America. And he's going to be the closing singer at the Myrtle Beach, the South Carolina Convention Tea Party, if I can get that straight. South Carolina Tea Party Convention up in Myrtle Beach.
That's like soon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's, what is it? Not this week and the following. That's in 2 weeks. Yes.
Right.
And we got a lot of friends in the chat room, want to welcome them all aboard. And some of them said they missed us. And we missed them, too.
Well, Mr. Knight, we missed you, too. Mr. Knight owns Knight's Party Store just down the road. Jack upped them prices. I was there this morning. but anyway, the store was started like in the early 1900s by like his relatives, and so I got a chance to talk to him, and he's like, "When y'all gonna get back on the air?" I said, "Whenever I come here, all you do is complain, anyways, about what we talk about." But anyway, that's great. And I'd like to welcome everyone, and also the GOP Gopher fan I've actually had a chance to meet. It's about 40 feet from me. It's very nice to meet people from our show, especially the ones around here. And they said they're spreading the word. And I forgot her name, but some girl told me a week ago she wants to win that bag. I don't remember her name, but anyway.
Here's the name.
Wait a minute. We're not drawing now, are we?
Nope. We're going to do that towards the end of the show, the last few minutes. Right. We're waiting for our guest, Mike Baker, to call in.
I've done some reading on Mr. Baker. I'm very excited to talk to him, not only as a former CIA officer and security consultant, but since then in the private sector, he's also started Baker & Company Diligence. This is we normally have pretty good guests. This guy's like an amazing guest as far as what he has done in his life. It's almost like, I'll bet you this guy's probably almost lost his life 100 times.
Yeah, he's also a frequent guest on Red Eye with Greg Gutfeld. Matter of fact, I believe he was on that last night. So hopefully he'll call in soon and we can get rocking and rolling here. You know, there's a whole lot that's been going on. Speaker Boehner has been reelected, and there was an attempt. There was an attempt by some of the more conservative and Tea Party GOP to undermine his return, and it did not work. Unfortunately, some of the people they relied on defected and pulled the party line. So Boehner, again, is going to be Speaker for the next 2 years.
Well, we've had so much go on over the holidays as far as political, but I don't want to keep our guests waiting. But I'll tell you something, is that I'm very proud of our Congressman Justin Amash, who not only was screwed over by John Boehner, but he voted for another person who was also tossed off Congressional Budget Committee. But so be it. However, no matter how bad it is to have Boehner, who I can't stand.
It's better than Pelosi.
She was like right behind him. So it's like, no, thanks. We'll keep bonehead.
All right. Well, let's welcome our guest aboard, and let's get rocking and rolling here. So good afternoon, Mr. Baker. Welcome to Southern Sense.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. We have our co-host, Cool Mike, with us. You are former CIA. You had spent 17 years in the CIA. You've now started your own company, Diligence, and you're also a frequent contributor on Red Eye with Greg Gutfeld. And I mean, I've watched you sometimes on that, and you have me hysterical. It's a pleasure to have
you. Thank you very much. That's kind of you to say. And Fox is a very good organization. Red Eye is the sort of show that you would never expect to see on a news outlet like Fox, but it's been around now for 5 or 6 years, and you know, by all accounts, it's doing well.
Wow. I absolutely love Greg Gutfeld. When he goes on The Five, always I have to sit back and wonder where his mind gets some of these things he comes up with.
He's one of the few guys I even like.
He doesn't like to let on that he's smart. He doesn't like to – I think sometimes he tries to hide it, but he's a very smart individual, a very good writer. And that developed over years before he got anywhere near Fox, when he was working primarily in print media, and he's got a very, as you can tell from the show, he's got a very sharp wit.
Yeah, and I love the way he always ends up foiling Bob Beckel. I just love it. You used to see the
Yeah, that can't be that
Beckel's
difficult,
ear.
Though. You know, God bless Bob, but I think it's not that tough to foil him, given his usual stance and positions on most things.
Yeah. Now, more towards the serious line, I'm former New York, you know, as you can tell from my dialect. And thankfully, I moved to the great state of South Carolina, where something like this would never happen. The releasing of the names and addresses of gun owners, legal gun owners who have committed no crime, have now had themselves exposed.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Although, you know, fairly typical of a certain academic liberal mindset. You know, they basically did this following on the heels of such a tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, and using that in sort of a pandering, self-righteous way to try to push their own agenda. And what they expected to gain from this, why they thought this was a good idea, is still difficult for people to understand. I mean, there is a lot of pushback and a lot of very, very upset people up here, not just gun owners or proponents of the Second Amendment, but just, you know, people in general view this as a serious invasion of privacy that crosses the line.
And absolutely. Now, I'm retired NYPD, and one of the things that was really enforced throughout the department is that no one gives out anyone's address, phone number, or anything, you know, specifically because you're afraid of retaliation. You know, you don't know who you're running into on the street day to day. You don't know who's going to come after you personally, your family. It's to protect your own safety. And, you know, if you have a gun in the house, you're just turning around and saying, hey, listen, thieves, if you don't see any cars in the driveway and no one's answering the doorbell, please break in and steal my firearms.
Right, right, right. It's bad on so many different levels. But the problem is that right now, I mean, the Putnam County clerk is trying to take a stand, and he's getting support from a variety of local representatives and others. He's trying to say, no, our county is not going to produce these records indicating who has a gun permit in our county. But the problem is the law as it stands right now is on the newspaper's side in their basically essentially their Freedom of Information Act. And so they can appeal, they can fight against it, but they've got to change this regulation that's on the books. In order to, you know, prevent this information from getting out. You go to other states, and that it's already written that way. This information is not publicly available. But a lot of these rules, including in Putnam County, were written well before, you know, the days of Facebook and YouTube and Google Maps and, you know, all this instant access. So this sort of scenario was never anticipated when, you know, some of these rules were put on the books.
No, that's true. Some of the laws, I believe, go back as far as 73, and the clerk's name up in Putnam is Greg Ball, if I'm correct. And I liked his reasoning because I liked the legal stance he was saying. He was saying that, hey, listen, you already have a law on the books that protects people from, you know, that are victims of domestic violence. If we cannot publish their names, and if they decide to go out and buy a gun, then you cannot publish their names. The same stands for, you know, law enforcement. You're not allowed to publish their names. And
right.
They're saying that, you know, if you're going to use that logic, then follow it through with the Freedom of Information Act and protect gun owners. Not just gun owners, just you cannot arbitrarily just publish someone's name if they have committed no crime.
Yeah, it's been an interesting debate so far. I mean, part of it is anytime you start talking about gun ownership, it becomes very emotive. Particularly from the far left side, they kind of lose their minds, and there's an inability to have a rational discussion because they have one agenda and that's it. And they don't, you know, they try as they might, where they try to position themselves as being reasonable. It never goes that way because the arguments always devolve very quickly into sort of this emotional rant. But I think with this, I have talked to some people who, as they'll say, well, look, I'm a parent of a child, and I kind of see that. This is maybe helpful to me because, you know, if my child is going to have a play date at another house, then maybe I can use this database and look online and see that, oh, yes, they have weapons in that home, or at least they have a permit to have a weapon in that home. And then you know, I say, well, so where does that leave you? You're just going to tell your child you can't have a play date? You know, and by the way, you got every right before your child has a play date to ask the parent, you know, straight up, look, do you have weapons in the home? If so, are they secured? I just, you know, that's the sort of thing I worry about as a parent. There's nothing preventing them from having those conversations. But putting this information out in the public domain like this, you know, for sort of this self-righteous stance that the journal wants to take, the newspaper wants to take, is, I think it's just disgusting.
And I completely agree. And common sense is, if you're sending a child to a play date, you want to meet the parents that the house, you know, you want to see the house. You want to make sure everything is fine. You know, are they drinking? Are they doing drugs? Are there unlicensed firearms? Are their firearms not properly secure? Is there a pedophile in the house? You want to know these things before you just arbitrarily send your kid off. But some parents don't want to take that responsibility. Instead, they'd rather blame you for their problems.
Well, and that's part of this whole debate over gun ownership. That's why, you know, anytime there's an unfortunate, sad tragedy, you know, the left, at least it seems to me, you know, their instinct is to always avoid all the difficult discussions about values and ethics and principles and sort of the bigger questions and just go straight for, well, no, we just have to take the guns away because, you know, from their perspective, that's just the easy thing to do. And it also kind of feeds this notion that, look, the big government is here to protect you. We'll take care of that. You as a citizen are too stupid or, you know, unable to do that yourself. So, you know, we don't want anyone to own guns. Let the government take care of you. And it all kind of feeds into, not to get at the 30,000-foot level, but it all kind of feeds into that big, big principle.
Yeah. Now, you have Illinois that's going to the extreme, and you have a Democrat that has advanced legislation to restrict semi-automatic weapons and high-capacity magazines. And the NRA, Todd Vandermeid, I believe, said that it would restrict about 75% of handguns and 50% of long guns in circulation today. And this is just going off the cliff just too far.
Well, particularly you look at a place like Chicago and you know, their gun control efforts there have resulted in 512 gun deaths in this past year. You know, the problem is, even though people will say, I'm going to say something, and I'm sure there'll be people out there listening that will say, well, that's typical. That's just exactly what you always say, which is, you know, if you were to take away the ability for legal law-abiding citizens to own weapons, then who's left holding the weapons? Well, I guarantee you, you know, none of your people with nefarious intent are going to say, oh, well, you know what, they banned this. I better go, you know, turn this one in. I don't have a right to own this anymore, so I'm going to hand mine over. Well, that's not going to happen. And so, but we don't have an ability on either side, really, to have a non-emotive discussion about gun control. So you talk about the extended magazines. Well, that's an example, or a waiting period. That's an example where, you know, in a rational world, you know, if you were going to have a debate, not driven by a tragedy because you've got a knee-jerk reaction to use that, you know, to push your agenda, but in general terms, over a period of time, if you're going to have a rational discussion, well, fine. You know, from my perspective, and I'm a huge proponent of the Second Amendment, but, you know, you do have to have these discussions. Extended magazines, you know, what can you do about that? Waiting periods. I've never woken up in the morning and thought to myself, you know, by 2 p.m. today, I got to get myself another weapon. You know, so, and I have a company that, I mean, we have teams that do nothing but due diligence. The more time you have to do due diligence and background check, usually the more thorough you are. It's not going to prevent a tragedy, but it's something that can be put on the table and had a rational discussion. If we don't, my concern is if the NRA, you know, if they don't think about what areas can we talk about rationally, then there is a concern I've got that in this current atmosphere, in this current administration, they're going to jam through some things that are going to be really dysfunctional and that we're not going to like.
Yeah, now I believe it's North Carolina that has a law in the books, and I forget what the law is called, but what they're doing is they're enforcing the current laws on the book, and they're saying, hey, listen, if we find you to possess a firearm illegally, it's automatically 5 years. You're away. You're going away for 5 years. If you're a criminal that possesses a firearm illegally, 5 years. If you attempt to purchase a firearm and it was an illegal purchase, I mean, if you're a criminal, you know, a felony background, if you're restricted from purchasing a firearm for whatever reason and you attempt to purchase
that information,
you simply attempt to, that's 5 years. And I believe they said they cut down crime by that 60% just by that one law.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very good point that you're raising and pointing to, which is you go after the people that are causing the problem, and don't have this typical knee-jerk reaction. No good decisions ever get made in Washington on the fly like this. They always want to do this. I mean, after 9/11, they just rushed through and decided, well, we've got to have the Director of National Intelligence. Well, that's a dysfunctional organization. It's never functioned the way it's supposed to. But it was thrown together out of a tragedy and in a knee-jerk fashion. And that's what Washington does best. They always push through. Look what they tried to do with the Sandy bill. And when someone says, well, wait a second, we're going to pass this bill because it's got billions of dollars that are completely unrelated to helping the people who suffered from this storm, then there's all this pushback because, oh, my God, well, you're just trying to prevent, us from helping these poor people. Well, no, you're trying to do something in a logical fashion. You can do it quickly, but, there's just so much crap that goes on in Washington. I'm afraid with the gun control issue, out of this Newtown tragedy, you're getting the potential for this. I mean, the whole reason for Joe Biden's panel to rush through with their recommendations is so Obama can, talk about them in his inaugural speech. And I just worry there's going to be some problems coming down the pike. So I think we need to set the table on the side of the Second Amendment to have some rational discussion about some of the issues. But we should also be willing to talk about things like violent video games, which the left usually is not because they start screaming about the First Amendment. Well, if you Google the top 5 video games out there, they're all shoot 'em up games. And you can't tell me that kids sitting around that are 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 years old spend hours just mindlessly shooting things on TV, that doesn't have some sort of desensitizing effect.
No, that's something I had brought up, that the children are not being exposed to proper gun safety. You should not fear the gun. You fear the person behind the gun. And if kids are taught, because you used to have in school where they had taught kids, how to handle firearms. But that came out of the schools back in the 60s. So now kids can't respect them because they're not being exposed to them properly.
Right. Right. No, that's absolutely true. And sound proper training, both in the care, maintenance, use, and storage, is something that's something that should be a part and parcel of the overall discussion. But it tends not to be because again, it sort of devolves into it's one thing or no way. It's all about we have to ban guns or that's it. And so the rush after a tragedy like Newtown is not unexpected. It's not surprising, but this time around, because of the map in Washington D.C. and the layout of the administration, it's more disconcerting, I think.
Yeah. Now you also have the Des Moines Register that wants to have the NRA labeled as terrorists. I mean, it's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. You vilify a legal organization, but yet you let the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE freely operate in our country.
Well, I mean, look at all the things that go on. I mean, in terms of our tendency to not focus where we should. I mean, we allowed this whole fiscal cliff debate to be a tax issue as opposed to, taxing the top 1% or 2%. If you want to vilify those people, fine, that's how you got reelected. But that's not what this issue is about. This issue is a mathematical equation that says if you don't cut your spending, you're not going to have enough money, no matter how much you tax, to pay for future government requirements. And then everybody's going to lose. And when you give people free stuff long enough, and then you try to take it away, whether you're talking about Greece, Portugal, Spain, or the U.S., those people get really, really upset. And we're working our way towards that day because nobody has the nerve or the wherewithal or the spine to deal with this problem because there's too much self-interest in Washington.
Yeah, now, I was up on Twitter. Of course, I'm always up there on Twitter. And I came across this one conservative. He calls himself Cap Black, the Hood Conservative. And he had an absolutely hysterical piece on his blog where he made the point that there are more attacks with hammers than committed by rifles. So why don't you then now ban the hammer? And I thought it was hysterical. I said, this
well,
is a perfect point.
I tell you what, I got a toolbox full of hammers. Nobody's coming and collecting my hammers. But you know, your point's well taken, because you can extrapolate and say, well, where, just like with censorship, where does it stop? Where does it end? And there is a lot to be said for holding a line, because at a certain point, once that line breaks, then the general assumption is that, you know, it can all go away. I worry that in the current environment, whether we're talking about gun control, whether we're talking about spending and revenue, whether we're talking about foreign policy, we've lost the ability, for whatever reason, in Washington to have reasoned, logical, common sense discussions and action. And we do end up with, situations where, like with the fiscal cliff, I mean, you could have predicted that a year ago, that we were going to have an 11th hour decision, and they were going to come up with something to basically just avoid the hard decisions. And why? Well, because self-interest, because they all knew that, they wanted to get reelected, and if they did nothing and they let it go off the cliff, that would jeopardize their reelection chance. And yet none of them wanted to push on the hard issues, because that might jeopardize their reelection decisions. So, long and short of it is nothing gets done. I'm sounding very
cynical. Of course. And, the Heritage Foundation 2 years ago predicted the fiscal cliff. And when I read that article 2 years ago, they were saying, watch this. They're going to wait for the elections to come through, and only then are they going to try to do something. But they're going to push it beyond the election so they can get themselves reelected. And that's exactly what happened. Heritage called it 2 years ago.
Yeah,
we were talking.
Yeah.
We mentioned before the Muslim Brotherhood, and you were up on, I think it was Fox News, you had gone in to talk about the U.S. sending tanks and F-16 fighters to Egypt to the Muslim Brotherhood.
This is an example of, exactly, it's an example of sort of the insane nature of Washington right now. We made a deal. We've been, obviously, Egypt and Israel, been number one and two in foreign aid for years and years and years. And we made a deal with Hosni Mubarak's government a couple of years ago for additional military hardware. And, of course, Hosni Mubarak is now in jail, and the Muslim Brotherhood is in control of Egypt, even though during the Arab Spring, they took a back seat and claimed they had no interest in that. They were just there to help. They do what they always do. The Muslim Brotherhood is a very patient, very sophisticated, very, very smart organization. And so they now are in control, exactly where they wanted to be. The people who have the most to lose in Egypt right now are all those academics, all those civil liberties folks, all the students, all the women's rights activists who actually were out there in the street at the beginning and actually caused the uprising and the Arab Spring and the removal of Mubarak. Those are the people that initiated that. And they're the ones who have the most to lose, because under the Muslim Brotherhood, they're not just taking a back seat in the bus, they're getting kicked off the bus. So anyway, as a result of the deal we made with Hosni Mubarak a couple of years ago, about on January 22nd, we're scheduled to deliver 10 F-16s fighter jets and then 200 M1A1 Abrams tanks, battle tanks, as part of a larger deal where later in this year we'll provide the Muslim Brotherhood-led government with another $1.5 billion in aid. Now, the way that we can prevent this is for President Obama to say, no, you know what, deal's off the table right now. You're going through a transition period. It's in our best interest to reevaluate this deal, understand where you're going, have further discussion, ensure that your interests are somewhat aligned with ours, because, that's what's key to our national security, and say we're not going to do the deal. But you don't hear much about it on Capitol Hill. I haven't heard anybody saying, yeah, we're going to scuttle this deal. And so I'm not quite sure if the administration is concerned about upsetting the Muslim Brotherhood by pulling this deal back, but everybody in the region and everybody around the world would understand why we're doing it. The government now is not the government we made the deal with, and yet we're about to hand over significant military hardware to the Muslim Brotherhood, and it's getting almost no attention.
No, and you have to remember, too, I believe it was about a year and a half ago, the Muslim Brotherhood came to the White House, sat down with Obama. They also had a couple of senior senators, one of them being my senator, Lindsey Rhino Graham, and they actually entertained the Muslim Brotherhood as if they are a legal political party here in the United States, or someone to be negotiating with, instead of as the actual terrorist organization they've been since 1920.
Right. Well, I mean, we have to. I agree with you. I mean, in the big picture, the problem is we do have to negotiate with them in some capacity, and because they are now legitimately in charge, and they also have seen increasing influence in other parts of the region, out in the Middle East, and so they are a force that has to be dealt with. But that doesn't mean that we have to, you know, deal with them as if they are a, you know, upstanding, freedom, peace-loving, democratic organization. And by the way, here's the tanks and the fighter jets. So we have to be smart. We have to use our own best interests to drive our foreign policy. But yet, what you tend to see in the current administration is somewhat of a pandering attitude towards the Muslim world, and also an apologetic attitude when we try to do things in our own best interests. And that is causing us problems around the world. We're losing leverage. We're losing credibility. We send mixed signals around the world, and that's never a good thing in foreign policy terms.
Mixed signals, like what's going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan? Jeez.
Yeah.
Do they even have a policy? Because right now going on drawdown, but I don't see any concrete policy.
Well, it's hard to say because they haven't really enunciated in the case of Afghanistan what the end game is. I've never quite understood what our upside is there anyway. We had a extremely successful tactical strategic mission that took place at the end of 2001 in Tora Bora, where we routed al-Qaeda, moved them out. People would say, wow, you didn't get bin Laden. Okay, give me a break. You know, the whole point of it was not just one person. It was the entire organization. And that was a very successful mission. But we should have walked out in the spring of 2002 and said, okay, we do this again. We're coming back, and we're going to have to, unfortunately, whack more of you. But instead, we allowed ourselves, for several reasons, to morph this into a nation-building exercise in a country that has never welcomed, such an effort, and view us as they viewed the Soviets, as they viewed every other foreign power, as occupiers. They don't even understand what we're trying to sell them. And now we're saying, well, we're going to leave in 2014, but not really. So now let's talk about the sort of size of troop levels we should leave behind. And I keep asking, to what end? What do you expect to gain from this? I'm not hearing a common sense, logical answer. I'm hearing a lot of theory, and I'm hearing a lot of, you know, hope and, hearts and mind stuff. And, one day we'll get this. But I just don't see it in our national interests to be spending excessive time, money, resource there anymore.
No, I don't either. And we do have a caller coming in. Let me see if I can bring this person up. And area code 910, you're on the air live with Southern Sense. To whom am I speaking?
Hello, Annie. This is Mark from North Carolina, and I was just calling in so I could listen to the show. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Nice people calling in to listen. Do you think anything is ever going to come of the Benghazi report, the flashing red report? I have read, and I've pulled up some other information. But do you think Hillary's ever going to go in front of Congress to testify?
Well, I think she will. I don't think she'll be able to get out of showing up at some point before she leaves that office. I think it's going to be a very bland testimony. I think she'll just reiterate what the report, the Accountability Review Board report, stated. She'll reiterate that she's instructed the State Department to follow all 29 of their recommendations. And I don't want to sound overly cynical, but I just don't see any real consequences coming from that. The review report was a statement of the obvious, essentially. The things that they pointed out, the problems that led to the deaths of those four individuals, we were talking about a day after the attack, over-reliance on untrusted, untrained, unvetted Libyan militia. The fact that it was a war zone, essentially, that we had an increasing threat profile, an increasing number of attacks and things that were ignored and cable traffic that wasn't dealt with properly, all those things. So they basically had a narrow parameter for writing that report, and they stuck to it. I mean, that's fine, but it didn't really say anything of any substance. And then they talked about how heads are going to roll as a result of it. Well, the four individuals, including the Assistant Secretary for Diplomatic Security, they all basically just got reassigned or will be reassigned. And that's the federal government way. It's very tough to remove anybody permanently from a position. And, you know, and really this administration just wants this story to go away. But I think Secretary Clinton will have to go up on the Hill. I just think that nobody should expect there's going to be any revelations or, interesting testimony that's going to take place.
No, they're going to do the same thing they did with Fast and Furious, just shuffle everyone around, sweep it under the rug, and just hope everyone forgets, you know, the next news item is going to push it out of the way.
Well, I suspect so. And you know, of course, you should learn lessons from Benghazi. We shouldn't have to learn those lessons, you know. And that's the sad part about it. But I think a bigger issue was, you know, why didn't they make an effort? Why didn't they try? Why during the course of that attack, while they're in the Situation Room, even though they could look and say, well, we don't really have assets there that are going to get there in time to likely save lives, and I don't believe they probably would have. I think that, but you still try. You still get the assets up in the air. You make the effort. And you do your best, because you don't necessarily know what's coming down the pike. We didn't know that there might not be a follow-on attack in Tripoli. And so get the boots on the ground. If nothing else, we would have secured that facility in Benghazi straight away. And at that point, then, we wouldn't have had the goat rope that followed, where we couldn't get investigators on scene for weeks. The whole thing was just dealt with very, very poorly. But I suspect, you know, there was a real political effort to avoid an attempted military response because of the uncertainty and the inherent risk and the fact that we had an election coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's funny how they timed it where it comes out after the election.
Certainly. Oh, absolutely. There was no, you know, I mean...
No planning in that.
But politics are politics, yeah, exactly. And so that
yeah,
shouldn't
no
be a surprise to anyone.
Yeah, what I loved is Leon Panetta had said that you don't send troops into unknown situations. But in December, he did exactly that when they went into Afghanistan to rescue a civilian doctor, and it cost the life of a SEAL. You know,
yeah, of course you send these troops into unknown situations. That's what they train for. That's their whole reason for being. You know, you expect the unexpected, and you know that you're not going to get all the intelligence you need before you rock up on a site. And if you wait for all that intelligence, something bad is going to happen. So that's what you train for. That's what you expect. That's what our special operators were expecting, you know, when they were on standby, trying to figure out whether they were going to get the jump call or not for Benghazi. And they didn't. And I think it was because you had likely, I'd love to see the logbook, the sign-in book for the war room at the White House to see who was there, because, you know, my guess, maybe I'm wrong, my guess would be there are several political operatives there with the election coming up. And I think that their risk versus gain calculation, that's what they went with, rather than a strategic, tactical, do the right thing, make the effort. You know, you don't leave people behind. And, the only reason we're going to lose more people or have a really messy hostage situation, which could still be going on, was because of my old outfits, you know, guys on the ground, the global response staff, and, you know, limited capacity. And their job is to hold off the Indians until the cavalry arrives. And you're supposed to send the cavalry, and we didn't.
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, Mike, I know you have a ton of questions.
Yeah, just a quick comment before what you just said. Even if you wanted to say that that politics wasn't part of this, the pieces together point 100% that it was. So, I mean, take that. People can take it with, you know, factual or whatever, but the idea that there was no politics, you can't even make a statement for that. But just if you look at the
right.
facts.
Right,
I agree with that.
That.
Putting these people, God knows when they sign up for these jobs or volunteer for the service or whatever, these people do this so unselfishly. And to just see how our government, and it's not just Barack Obama, this goes back years, how they don't value the life of our soldiers, but our individual soldiers, the Marine Corps, and so how they value each other, their brothers and their sisters, but our government doesn't. It's really a sad situation. Another thing, going back to what we talked about, I believe in the Freedom of Information Act, and I believe the media should have access to all that. I don't think we should have to register guns. I think the Second Amendment is exceptionally clear. We have the right to bear arms, period. That means government doesn't get involved. I think what you said, really, when you cross a barrier, states should decide certain things, but when you cross a line, as you mentioned in Afghanistan, when you cross a line, then all of a sudden you have all kinds of just everything. You know, you're giving up this rule. The next thing, you're giving up two things. And I think you pointed out 5 million great facts, I think, with the Patriot Act. We just jumped into a big fear over 9/11, and here we are now with the NDAA. It's just like it never, never ends.
That's sort of a result of the way that Washington decision making gets driven. You know, it's oftentimes it's not well thought out because they're reacting to the moment, they're reacting to the outrage, or they're reacting to the emotion, and you know, you get these bills or these regulations or these ideas or these organizations created, and you know, they stand around and pat themselves on the back because they've done something. But, you know, sometimes the best thing you can do is take a step back, take a breather, you know, look and learn, and then take some action.
Yeah, well, these gun rights don't apply to government. They just apply to people like you and I who abide by the law. I have a kind of a question going on your background. When Annie mentioned you're going to be on the show, I got fascinated. I was like your secret stalker online, reading about all the things you've done. And it was just amazing. How beneficial has it been over the life, based on your experience, for us even to wheel and deal in the CIA? It seems, at least from a layperson's perspective, it's always come back to bite us in the booty very hardcore. But you know an awful lot more than any of us know.
So in terms of, I mean, maybe if you could rephrase that.
What are some of the great things by being involved with this? What are some of the good benefits that we don't know about that has happened?
If I read that correctly, I mean, you're right. You tend to hear only about the bad things because that oftentimes makes for a more interesting story, and the good things don't get publicized anyway because that's not the point of the agency. You don't pat yourself on the back and you don't publicize your successes. So, you know, in the short term being a decade or so since 9/11, I'd say one of the good things that happens is the fact that, you know, we haven't had another similar attack on our soil. And that's not a result of some happy circumstance. That's not just blind luck. Luck always plays a role in every operation, at least that I was involved in. But for the most part, it's down to a tremendous amount of hard work that never gets seen or recognized. And, you know, so what happens is that there's the occasional incident that maybe gets publicized because it's out in the public domain. So you'll get the Times Square bombing. You'll get a couple of other incidents where people say, oh, okay, well, that was prevented by whatever reason. But there are behind the scenes countless plans, operations, intentions, efforts by Al-Qaeda and elements that are relatively like-minded that have been disrupted, prevented, minimized because of all the work that goes on. Not just with Mild Alpha, with the agency, but with NSA and a variety of federal and state and local organizations. So that's a real, as far as I'm concerned, that's a real bright point that rarely gets publicized. The only time you really hear about the CIA is when, you know, they're getting their ass kicked up on Capitol Hill, you know, because they're an easy scapegoat. They don't fight back. You know, they don't come back at you because that's not their job. And, you know, for the most part, the last thing they want to do is get in a discussion about sources and methods. So they tend to just turn the other cheek, and then they usually get smacked there too, because it's, you know, it's easy for congressmen or senators to do that. But it's a very honorable, very thoughtful organization. And I think if anybody took the time when those Justice Department memos were released during the course of the big debates over rendition, interrogation program, et cetera, harsh techniques, you know, the folks that I talked to, they came away with a real different understanding as to the way that the agency works, and it's not a cowboy organization. There was thought behind every time. There was limited use of these harsh techniques. You know, the media made it out, and the far left made it out to seem like that's all we were doing, and nothing could be further from the truth. But they successfully grabbed this bizarre high ground that, you know, they could stand there and say, "Well, you guys, all you do is torture." Well, what a load of crap. So, you know, it's a terrific organization. Other things that are important is that what we do overseas, in the traditional sense, the organization was put together to essentially protect the national interests of the United States. And you know, it's a, you know, it was originally a very old school espionage tradecraft organization. You know, the past decade, it's, you know, the perception is always that it's sort of a paramilitary organization. Well, we have a paramilitary group that's, as far as I'm concerned, second to none. But you know, the traditional work of the agency continues, you know, to assess and understand, you know, and get ahead of those nations out there that are operating against our interests. So there's a great deal of work that goes on. People just don't see it because it's not, you know, we don't put it up on the radar screen.
Okay, yeah, well, hang on, one more question, Annie. Kind of a non-political type question. All the places you've been around the world, what is the coolest abroad city where you go to and you're just like, wow, this is a cool city?
You know, I Beirut would probably be one of them. Because it's just the people are great. First of all, Lebanese people are fantastic, and they've just been constantly given the short end of the stick by whether it's the Syrians or the Iranians. And you know, it's a shame what's happened there. But it's a fascinating city with an incredible culture and history. So I'd have to put Beirut up there towards the top. And then other cities are for a variety of other reasons. Venice, Italy, I think everybody should get to Venice at least once before they pass away. And then, you know, there's a variety of bizarre places in Asia. Iraq is a fascinating place, and Iraq during 2003 and 2004 was a complete disaster, a complete mess, and that made it a very interesting place to be. Algeria during the real insurgency out there, when there was a major problem, that was probably one of the most difficult environments I'd seen. Every place has its own. It's a great question you ask. I never really thought about it before, but you know, every place, I think it depends on what's going on in the place. That's what makes it usually interesting for me. I guess because what I used to do or what I do is, you know, the more chaos or the more interesting it is at that moment, to me, it makes it more interesting to be there. That's not a very good answer, but it's a fascinating question.
Go ahead, Ann.
No, I was going back to what you were talking about before. I'm curious because having been in NYPD, and sometimes we would have someone from the intel division come down to us and they say, we've got information on, have a source that told us about this and this and that going on. I'm wondering, how much do you have that you end up passing on to local law enforcement and let them handle the situation, take credit for it?
There's a fair amount that goes through sort of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, where you have representatives from all the various organizations at all the different levels. So there's a great sharing of information, certainly compared to even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 12 years ago. I mean, it's vastly improved, in part because it was driven out of 9/11, and that wasn't a DNI or a federal government effort. We've been working on it for years, trying to improve the movement of actionable intelligence to all the various organizations that need it. But 9/11, you know, clearly focused everyone like nothing else had. And so there's been a vast improvement in the way that we work with the local, state, and federal agencies in taking a piece of actionable intelligence from the field, and that could be out in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Venezuela or wherever it might be, and getting that to the different organizations, as disparate as they may be, that need to work with that piece of information, that need that to further an investigation or further an operation, whatever it may be. So that part of it is really, really improved. And that's another thing that the public should be pleased about when they think about, well, how have we learned lessons? And again, that shows out in our ability to minimize, disrupt, or prevent planned operations that are, you know, in the works by Al Qaeda and others. So, you know, it's a long answer to your question.
All right. Well, I'm going to change the subject a little bit here. I'm going to bring up the thing that Al Gore just recently sold current TV to Al Jazeera. Oh, my God. Now, Glenn Beck tried to buy it, and he was told no. So instead, he sells it to Al Jazeera. You got to comment on this. You've got to.
Yeah. First of all, I don't know. They're obviously not buying eyeballs or viewers from current TV because I don't think they had more than a couple. But they're buying the access that the cable TV that the current TV had through their contracts with the cable companies around the country. And Al Jazeera, I think, realized that. I mean, and they do. Al Jazeera has a strikingly large number of viewers here in the U.S., and so they're looking to expand their footprint. In terms of doing a deal, I understand why Al Jazeera, looked to make this deal with Current TV. My feeling is the best part of the story is Al Gore's, self-righteous, sermonizing in the past about everything from, big oil to, paying your fair share in taxes. And then what does he do? He sells his company to a large petrochemical state, and he tries a tax dodge, before the end of the year in order to save money on capital gains, because he's making about $100 million off this deal. So, I don't begrudge, I'm in business myself. I'm a huge believer in working hard in the capital markets and doing what you can and pulling your boots up. But don't be self-righteous about it. Don't tell other people how to live their lives and then do something that's so obviously against what you've been talking about and sermonizing about. So, I don't know. To me, it's enormously interesting, but it just points out what it's just a contradiction in everything that he's said in the past.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that Time Warner already said they are dropping the contract. They are not going to have Al Jazeera on their networks. I want to see how many others decide to do the same thing, and just
I think the Time Warner thing is interesting because I suspect they had something in their contract that allowed them to basically get out of the contract with Current TV if they should sell, and then renegotiate. And I'll bet that Time Warner tries to renegotiate with Al Jazeera just at a lower rate. So nobody. I don't know that many companies that do things out of ideological reasons. So my feeling is Time Warner is doing this because it's good business sense for them, and they'll probably end up signing on to zero at a much more favorable rate than they had with Current TV. Although, I can't imagine who's paying for Current TV. And so that'll be interesting to see. But you're right in pointing out that Time Warner did drop them pretty quickly.
Yeah. No sooner was the ink signed and they unsigned.
I have a question. I'm not going to let you. You got to answer it just straight up. How accurate throughout not only today but yesterday and say 10 years ago, 20 years ago is American media?
How accurate?
Yeah. You've been abroad.
Yeah.
You see what's really going on. You see our news. How much of it is just plain out hogwash, BS, and how much is accurate? How much is politicized? I mean, you know for a fact what we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, but I think that there's a difference between accurate and objective or subjective. And so, in the sense of, I think what we don't have anymore is we don't have media just reporting the facts without a slant. So I think that, you have to look at the way that they present their information. They've got, they may have great reporters working overseas to gather facts, but then in the editorial process, because it fits that outlet's agenda, how does it get presented? And that's what we're missing. I mean, you remember the days, I'm old enough to remember the days when, your news came from the evening news. You'd sit down and, some well-respected anchor on the national news would read you the news. They would talk about the news, and they would tell you, here's the event, here's what's happening, here it is. And there was no sermonizing, there was no opinionating, there was no discernible slant, even though, of course, they must have had one. We don't have that for the most part anymore. So what that means is that you have more and more people listening to information that suits their own belief system, or you have people who make the effort and they go out and they listen to lots of different things, trying to understand, to your point, what's accurate and what's not. But I think you raise a really, really interesting but complicated question.
Well, because I see, I like your show, Red Eye, and I like O'Reilly. Other than that, I I think Fox is as bad as all the other ones. But Sean Hannity's always criticizing media abroad or in other countries, as well as every single station but his own. My question there is, you know, how do we really know? You are someone who has had boots everywhere. Your boots have been on the ground all kinds of places. So when you're watching a report, not only do you see the truth, you see between the lines, but your average John and Jane Doe watching American TV can't. We just don't know because we're not there.
Yeah, you know what you have to do is you have to increase your number of sources of information. I think you have to, you know, otherwise you're right. I mean, and you look at Fox News and you know, my perception of Fox, and you know, of course, I have a dog in the hunt, and I am subjective. I admit that, but their news blocks, not their opinion shows. You know, not a show like Sean Hannity, and he's the first to admit he's got an agenda, obviously. But their news blocks, where they're, you know, during the course of the day, where it's primarily the delivery of information and news, they do more than others try to present both sides of the story. They'll have somebody on there who's a dissenting view. For the most part, during the course of a panel discussion or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, CNN, they tend to try to do the same thing. And so you have a couple of outlets that will make the attempt. But, yes, can you say that there's any one outlet that is completely objective? I think objectivity has probably always been a myth in the media anyway. It's just been, you know, hidden in the past. And now it's okay to go out there and say, well, you know, this is what we stand for. This is our perspective. And, you know, our news is going to be coming from that perspective. But foreign news, BBC is very good. BBC continues to be, even though, you know, they do have an agenda. But their coverage is very good. Their reporters tend to be very well-versed in whatever area they're covering. They tend to keep their people out in the field for long periods of time. And so, you know, when I'm overseas, you know, I tend to be watching BBC. I'll listen to BBC here in the States. It helps that I'm, you know, a dual citizen and still have my British citizenship. I have a lot of respect, and despite the problems the BBC has had recently and in the past, their news operations tend to be very good.
No, I kind of like Sky News. How do you feel about them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sky's good. Sky is good. Yeah, they don't have the resources necessarily, but they're quite good. And there are others. I mean, if you to be honest with you, if you want to know, you know, real in-depth coverage of issues in Arab Spring, whether it's in, you know, Bahrain or it's in Egypt or wherever, Al Jazeera is a good source of information. Why? Because they know the region better than any other news outlet, and they have the boots on the ground. They have the reporters. They have the coverage. You know, so you watch it knowing, you know, you're watching a news outlet owned by an Arab state like Qatar, but you watch it because you're probably going to get coverage and insight that you're not going to get from anybody else. So you have to, you know, it's down to the individual. It's like everything else. We've kind of lost the responsibility, and I'm a big proponent of, you know, self-sufficiency and saddle your own bronc, but, you know, I think we've lost that, and people want to, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes, I don't want to say people get lazy because I don't think I know that many lazy people, but it becomes more difficult for people to get a well-rounded diet of information.
Yeah, talking about well-rounded diet, have you heard about this magazine in France that has now the 65-page cartoon biography of the Prophet Muhammad? Can you ask yourself what they were thinking?
Yeah, I don't
know. Well, they're thinking of a way to get rich is what I think they're thinking. Everybody's coming with
them. That's probably a good point. Yeah, I don't even know where you go with that. It's interesting. I will say that, you know, it can be frustrating at times when you you know what? I have a policy. I try not to discuss religion, so I'll step back at that point.
Okay, you won't discuss religion. Let me ask you a question. Based on your experience, I mean, obviously you've seen an awful lot more than your average everyday Joe. What president would you say utilized the CIA and intelligence for whatever, how many years their administration, whether it was 4 or 8 years, to America's advantage the best? Where they were just a bad ass.
Yeah,
In my time, I'd have to say George Bush Sr., because he understood the agency, he was a director, and he really understood the world of operations. I'd have to say Ronald Reagan, because he, you know, he had a respect for the organization. He had very close relations with the director, and there was a sort of a seamless existence there. So those two, in the recent history, I would say would be the best. George Bush Jr. Had a very healthy respect for the organization, and he was the sort of commander in chief who provided the instruction and then said, you know, I don't know the world of operations. That is, you know, I'm not going to micromanage. And that's what you have to hope for. The worst thing you can do is get, you know, somebody in charge who doesn't understand what the agency is supposed to do and what their capabilities are and wants to dictate everything anyway. It's like anything else. I mean, I don't pretend in the course of running my business to know, you know, better than most of the people that we've hired. We hire them because they're very smart, and most of them are a lot smarter than me and my partner. So we let them go. You know, we tell what their objectives are and then let them go. And they understand what the parameters are in terms of operations, and they work within those parameters. But you don't micromanage. But Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan were just exceptional in their appreciation for the agency and the people and, you know, what they needed to accomplish.
So when you, if, I don't know if this is even a question you can answer. Well, when you have been doing your ops, do people know who you are, or are you just a John Doe strolling along the road?
Well, for the most part, I mean, it depends on what the job is, but you're usually operating in, you know, some cover capacity. You're usually operating off the radar screen. Your whole goal is to, you know, have things done and not have anybody know. I mean, if things are blowing up and, you know, people are, you know, bursting into flames, then you got a goat rope and it's not going the way it's supposed to go. You know, that's how it happens in movies. But your whole job is to you know, operate and perform your tasks and meet your objectives without making any noise or being noticed. That's what your goal is. You know, that's why, you know, for the most part, unless the CIA is getting kicked around a hill, people just don't think about it. You know, and they shouldn't. You know, because that's just, you know, the world. Everybody wants to, you know, the banging on about transparency. You know, we have a right to know everything. Well, that's not true. You know, the world is not a inherently risk-free area, and so you need some ability to keep secrets, and the CIA is very good at that given the opportunity, you know, and unless the White House is inclined to leak secrets for political reasons, which unfortunately has happened in the recent past.
Yeah, that reminds me of the announcement with Bin Laden that Obama did. And then when I was listening to it, and I'm shaking my head, I'm going, how many operations did he just blow wide open? How many things has he just, that was on the burner, has he just killed? I didn't think it was the wisest thing he did. If he had kept his mouth shut, and the longer he did, the longer you would have had time to work these assets and shut down more of the operation. It drove me crazy.
Well, no, they did. They've done that several times, the AQAP disclosures were completely egregious. And, you know, remember there was supposed to be an investigation into leaks. Well, you know, again, Washington is a place where all good intentioned investigations go to die, apparently, much like the Benghazi investigation. You know, I just don't see anything happening from it. But, yeah, you sign up to the organization and the people working inside the agency and the NSA and all those other good organizations. They understand they're supposed to keep their yap shut. Sometimes they find it hard to do. But, you know, you would like to think that the administration, the White House, would not be driving some of those leaks. And it wouldn't be tough to figure out, in terms of looking at the leaks that took place over the course of the past couple of years, just simply in terms of who had access to that information. You know, that there's a record of who has access to certain types of operations, certain types of reporting. And so you take those people, it's going to be a short list,
and then you request that they submit to a polygraph. And if they say no, then you take away their clearances, and you thank them very much, and you tell them to go find another job. And yet we don't have that ability to do that. We just don't. We don't seem capable of taking action, of doing, you know, the necessary. And it's a shame.
Why is it? I mean, everyone. All I ever hear out of these moron Republicans is how they can't stand the union. It protects lazy people. The feds. How is it so hard to get rid of a file clerk with the federal government? They have no protection. It just seems like these people are. They have the best union on the planet, and it doesn't even exist.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. You know, there's a lot of, you know, and I don't want to vilify, you know, federal government workers. They don't deserve it because there's countless workers that do a terrific job. Is there dead wood in the system? Of course there is. There's dead wood in every organization in the private and public sector. But, you know, it's the leaks that I'm referring to, unfortunately, I believe, came, you know, from fairly high up in the White House. For political purposes, for political gain. And those are the ones that I think do the most damage, because what happens is, it's just like within the military, if the lower ranks, if the staff officers see the commanding officers feeling at ease with going out there and talking about things they shouldn't talk about, or being quoted in the press, or, you know, anonymously talking about something, and it's clear that it could only come from a handful of senior ranking officers, then that emboldens the ones, you know, below them, the junior officers and others, that say, well, crap, it's okay for them to do it. And that's what you get when, you know, a White House has a problem with leaks. You know, you get other people in the government, you know, with access who think, well, what's wrong with me talking anonymously to the New York Times? And now you got the New York Times, they can make entire front page stories out of nothing but anonymous sources. And, you know, people just, there's an inability to keep their pie hole shut, because I think there's no consequences for it. And that's what we need to get back to. But, you know, that's just me sermonizing. Look at that. I'm like Al Gore sermonizing.
that was the question they asked. When you were in Iraq, what would you say, throughout your career, what are maybe one or two things that maybe you had, maybe not your hands in, that you saw that when it took place, you were like, wow, this is history taking place. Something that's just, I mean, that when sometimes you reflect, which people like you tend to never reflect, all the great things you've done, you're so unselfish as you speak about your team. But what's like one or two things that's just, wow, this is just something amazingly awesome?
You know,
work related.
This is like the world's worst answer to a question on radio or TV, but I've got answers to that, but I'm going to keep it to myself. And I know that's a terrible answer.
I suspect if one sit down was caught, you wouldn't be able to answer because obviously.
No, Mike, think about this. We're just talking about keeping your pie hole shut, and you're asking him to open his mouth.
Well, I mean,
I know.
Maybe who knows?
Maybe I can sell my company to the government of Qatar.
I worked for a lieutenant colonel for years when. Every time I would ask him questions, he'd be, I was in the Army. I know you were in the Army, but what were you doing? I was overseas. I know you were overseas. What was your job? Defending the states. It'd be like the same thing over and over. Here's a question you can't answer. What made you start this company, Diligence LLC? I mean, it just seems, you could read on some of this stuff forever.
You know what? I started with a very, very close friend of mine who came out of the British teams, and we started it because we honestly weren't smart enough to do anything else. We both knew we wanted to get out of our services at the time, primarily me because my daughter was getting older and I was just never around, and so I wanted to reorder my priorities, and so we honestly didn't. You know, it wasn't like we had a grand plan, but we knew kind of what we knew. And so we set up a shop that kind of capitalized on intelligence and security risk mitigation concerns and hoped that it might work. And we, you know, frankly, we've been very lucky in the people we met and some of the things that we had a chance to do early days that helped us move along and grow. And you know, like I said before, luck plays a role, I think, to some degree in everything. And we got very fortunate. We got very lucky in building what now is, I think, a relatively successful global business.
A lot of people that are in the services end up going to some form of security or intel. I know a lot of my friends that got out, and they ended up working for different security companies and different intelligence agencies.
Yeah, we had to, we had to start our own company because we both realized we'd be the world's worst employees. We've been in positions where you're given a great deal of responsibility and a great deal of leeway, and you know, I think neither of us saw us, you know, working in a corporation or a company or even a small business that, you know, wasn't ours, because we felt that nobody would have us, basically. So, you know, we started our own company out of necessity, I think, at the end of the day.
Well, it's always better to work for yourself than to work for someone else. You have something that you feel like you're achieving in the end, and you're not just putting money in someone else's pocket. You're putting it in your own.
Well, it's enormously rewarding, because you're creating an environment for other people, and you're hiring people, you're giving them opportunity, and that's the best thing. The best thing about our company is our people, and that's been the most rewarding part of this, is all the folks we meet, both on you know, within our staff and also the people that we work for and on behalf of. I mean, some of my best friends at this point are folks that started out as initially as clients, and we've developed very great relationships with these people in their companies, and so that's been really rewarding. You know, there's challenges and there's concerns and yada yada yada, but you know, so be it. I don't want to make myself sound clever. It's a lot of luck involved.
No, that and a lot of talent too. Mike, you have been a fantastic guest. The time has flown so fast.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun. No, it's been a lot of fun, and you know, just give me a shout anytime. I enjoy the format very much, and I thought the questions were terrific.
Don't ever say that, man. I could have you on for 3 more hours with all my questions. One final question for me, which you can't answer. Your favorite restaurant abroad. What country, what city, where this food is just, wow, this is awesome.
Oh, wow.
I'm a person who would love to travel, but other than the 3 blocks of my house, I've never been anywhere. So places you're talking about, I'm like, wow.
there's a little farmhouse in Italy, in the section of Italy called Emilia Romagna, and it's run by a small family, and they turned a part of it into a small cooking school, and they've got maybe 8 tables in there at the most, I think. And it's the best food I've ever had. And I love Italian food, and there's some great Italian restaurants in New York City. Il Molino's down in Little Italy is an incredible experience. But this little place out in the middle of nowhere, it doesn't look like anything, and it's not a particularly attractive part of Italy. I mean, it's attractive, but it's not like, you know, like Lucca or some of the other places or Venice. But it's just, you go in this little farmhouse, and it's incredible. And the care that they take in making the food, and it's the local wine that's made right there. And it's pretty special.
Wow.
But anyway, that would be my choice. And then, of course, there's always Chick-fil-A. And my little boys, the 5, 3, and 1-year-old, they're convinced there's nothing better on the planet than the waffle fries from Chick-fil-A. So, you know, there you go.
I went to Chick-fil-A just because of the controversy. The waffle fries were the only thing I really liked about there. But, you know, kids are kids. But, wow,
exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us. Man,
sure.
You just...
Thank you, guys.
I don't even want them to go, Andy. Maybe we should tackle them and keep them.
Well, thank you very much. Just give me a shout anytime. I'd be happy to jump back on.
Thanks a lot, Mike. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Man, all those great places he's been. What are we doing here, Andy? Oh, we could travel everywhere. All these good restaurants and countries.
I used to own a travel agency, and I used to do that, just be able to hop on a plane or hop on a cruise ship and just go. But, hey, we got something coming up.
Okay, here we go, ladies and gentlemen.
This is our little bucket with 140 names from people that have either been a follower here on Blog Talk Radio or signed up onto our website, which is southernsense.webs.com. This is our drawing.
Maybe you should have Yanni draw the name. You might get accused of being biased.
Yanni's out right now helping a friend. But this is for the tote bag that we've been shouting about now. So here we go. Just letting you know, I'm making sure these names are all mixed up. and randomly got to pick one out. And who do we have? I'm not even looking. Okay, we got one. Ah!
All right.
We've got Rick Below. Rick Below, who is one of our listeners. He is the one that won the tote bag. So,
Well. Awesome. And I will, tomorrow, I will send you your Playboy energy to put in there. Wow.
Okay. So one of our good listeners, Rick Below, you are the winner of the tote bag. So I'm going to shout you out and give you an email. And that way you can give me the address so we can ship out the Playboy energy drink and the tote bag to you. Remember, go onto the website, southernsense.webs.com, and I think the next thing we're going to give away is one of our coffee mugs. How does that sound?
Well, that sounds awesome. Wow. That's really cool. I'm happy for Rick. It's like our first giveaway. It's like we're growing. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, we're coming up on 250,000 downloads. So, yes, we're doing fine. We are going to... have great guests coming up. On Tuesday, we're having two co-authors. We have Colin Heaton coming back. He's the one that wrote The Star of Africa. He's got about a dozen books out, all on military history. And we're also going to have Adam Makos, who wrote the book, right behind me, A Higher Call. And it's an incredibly true story of combat and chivalry in war-torn skies of World War II. I am down to the last few chapters, and I got to one point last night that I'm walking around the house with the book open because I just couldn't stop reading it. It is so riveting. It is an excellent book. And then after that, following Friday, we're going to have Chuck Woolery. Yes, TV game show host Chuck Woolery, who is a solid conservative. He will be on next Friday.
He's got the great original shows Wheel of Fortune, isn't he?
Yeah, Love Connection. He's got another game show, I think, up on Game Show Network now also. Plus, he's got a couple of websites out where he sells fishing gear and stuff. And he's got a fantastic video up on YouTube about not taking his guns away. It's a great video. So join us again next week, same bat time, same bat station, for wonderful guests and more of Cool Mike and I. So.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and God bless to you all. See you next week.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American. Back down, stand up and shout it out, stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.